Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We'd like to extend a warm welcome to our new listeners on the new community station KRJF in Santa Rosa. If you have friends in Santa Rosa, let them know that they can now hear Your Call live at 10 a.m. on 92.3 FM, and we look forward to having you join the conversation. On today's Your Call, we are discussing a provision that was buried in the Republican tax cut bill to, quote, help distressed Americans. The law creates opportunity zones, which are designed to encourage investors to spend money in low-income and underserved neighborhoods, and in return, they will get a capital gains tax cut. More than 3 million Californians live in areas that could be designated as opportunity zones, but who really makes these decisions? And who has a seat at the table? How is this policy shaping up, and what do we need to know about it? It really didn't get much attention when the tax cut bill was, well, barely being debated in Washington, D.C. Joining us is Rochelle Riley, Director of Impact Investing at Enterprise Community Partners. It's a community development and affordable housing organization. Hi, Rochelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
Great to have you. I'm guessing that a lot of people did not know that this was in the tax bill. According to the New York Times, these opportunity zones were included by Senator Tim Scott, a South Carolina Republican. It was based on a bill that he co-sponsored with several Democrats, including Senator Cory Booker. And it also is being supported by a Washington think tank, the Economic Innovation Group, and Sean Parker, who made a lot of money off of Napster and Facebook. Can you tell us more about where this originated? Whose idea is this, really?
Sure. It was actually introduced originally through the Investing in Opportunity Act in the 114th Congress. Both bipartisan and bicameral, by Senator Cory Booker and Senator Tim Scott in the Senate, and then Congressman Pat Tiberi and Congressman Ron Kind. It was supported across the aisle in both the 114th Congress and then reintroduced in the 115th back in February 2017, really around this idea of providing preferential tax treatment on private investments into distressed communities could really be transformative in community investing and seeing a real difference in plugging an equity gap that is missing through impact investing and what we're seeing for community needs.
Preferential tax treatment. So someone who spends money in these communities across the country that are deemed opportunity zones will get a reduction in their capital gains tax. Is that how it works?
That's correct. So the real innovation around the legislation, Investing in Opportunity Act, and which is now known as the Opportunity Zones Program, is that instead of using what we typically would think of as an appropriation or an authorization of capital through traditional legislation, what this does is it taps the unrealized capital gains market, which is estimated right now at $2 to $6 trillion. So these are assets that, through stocks or mutual funds, are sitting on the books of individuals or corporations currently. And once they realize these capital gains, they have an option. Either they would pay capital gains taxes the year that they realize that income on those investments, or they now could roll that those earnings into opportunity funds, which are now authorized to invest into distressed communities, which are eligible to receive investments, and those distressed communities are going to be designated as opportunity zones, and that's the process that we're in right now.
Now, these opportunity zones have not yet been established. The first deadline for states to select them is tomorrow, and California has an interactive map, and you can find that map at yourcallradio.org, and it gives an overview of which census tracts are eligible for becoming opportunity zones. What is a census tract?
A census tract is, throughout the nation, there are areas that are divvied up by population. And so a census tract has a certain number of people that are in an area, and it has a certain demographic associated with it. And so right now, opportunity zones, based on the eligibility of the Opportunity Zones program, are on the basis low-income census tracts. So the communities that are going to be eligible to receive this private capital through opportunity funds are low-income census tracts by and large.
What are your thoughts about the process? How are these areas really selected? If you look at numbers, to be eligible, a tract needs to have a poverty rate of at least 20%, or the family income needs to be 80% or less of the statewide or citywide median income. Talk about the process involved in this.
So the process right now, what's happening is that governors had 90 days to select which census tracts would be designated over the next 10 years to be opportunity zones, which means they'd be eligible to receive this investment. And of all of the eligible census tracts, they could designate up to 25% of those. And throughout the nation, what we're seeing is a varied number of levels of engagement by the governors. And in California, it's been a really interesting process. And what we've really been encouraging states and governors to think about from a community engagement standpoint is to absolutely be, you know, both quantitative in your methodology around identifying what would make a reasonable decision around a zone allocation, but also to ground truth a lot of those assumptions by engaging with the public, because a lot of times it's the folks working on the ground, the local stakeholders, that are going to know best. Those are the people that are working with the community, that are living in those neighborhoods, that are going to understand the very specific dynamics of how the community operates, of what the local plans, the local economic development initiatives are in those communities, and whether or not the capital coming from opportunity funds are going to best be put to use in those localities. And so we've really been urging governors to involve the community early. This was a 90-day process, which is by all means a sprint to the finish line, especially since, as you mentioned early in the program, this was tucked into tax reform. It was not a program that was widely announced. So there was a large outreach effort by Enterprise, by the Economic Innovation Group, and many, many others at the outset. And many states have been quick to respond, but even quick within a 90-day window is difficult. And so states, again, have been engaging the public in a number of different ways. But one of the things that states have the option to do in this moment is, even though tomorrow is the first deadline for submitting those nominations, the other thing that they can opt in to do tomorrow is to request a 30-day extension. So Enterprise and others have been saying states should absolutely be requesting that 30-day extension. There's no downside to doing it. And what it does allow is for additional public input, additional public engagement, and an opportunity to, again, ground truth a lot of the assumptions that states may have made in their additional quantification of and analysis of those census tracts.
What do you think about some of the areas that have been highlighted? A few of them just don't make any sense. Alcatraz is one of them. So is a portion of the Stanford University campus. East Palo Alto, which is near Stanford, is eligible but not recommended. And over the past couple of months, there's been so much good reporting, disturbing reporting, about the high homeless rate in East Palo Alto. It's just right next to some of the big tech companies in Silicon Valley. So can you talk about that? And since there's just one day left, how can people make their voices heard?
Yeah, absolutely. My understanding of what Governor Brown's methodology was to take a purely algorithmic approach in dividing the state proportionally and, for lack of a better term, divvying up a census tract allocation and then utilizing some quantification around different metrics for benchmarking how these zones were going to be allocated. And so that's why you're seeing sort of this scattered and maybe zone selection or zone nomination that may not make too much sense. And for that reason, this is why this ground truthing is so important. And I believe the process in California was that California did this initial assessment. They put forth this map to the public, and they requested feedback on this map. However, that feedback was due in less than a two-week turnaround time. And a number of different coalitions provided feedback, really great feedback, including California Forward, California Reinvestment Coalition, and many, many others. And not only on census tracts, but also on best practices of what the governor should be considering. And to that end, I think that that ground truthing process was really important and should continue to be important. And that's why that 30-day extension is of utmost value right now to the governor. And we are hoping that folks continue to reach out to the governor either directly or through social media. We have seen social media in a number of cases be an important method of getting a hold of states and localities in this short window.
Rachel Riley is Director of Impact Investing at Enterprise Community Partners, a community development and affordable housing organization. And now I would like to welcome Lisa Hall to the show. Lisa is a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
It's nice to have you. You just wrote a piece about these so-called opportunity zones, and you ask a couple of very important questions. Will investments be carefully constructed with the people who are living in underserved communities at the heart of these decisions? I mean, that's one of the biggest questions here. If you're going to have people with a lot of money come into a poor area, I mean, we've seen this many times. What about buy-in from the community? Who actually has a seat at the table and who will be making these decisions?
So we think that once the zones are designated, that investors are going to be making decisions fairly quickly about what types of investments and in which zones they will invest. And we believe that there is an opportunity for community engagement. You know, there is a whole industry of impact investors who care about social outcomes that can be influenced to create their own rules and kind of a self-policing around types of impact objectives for making these investments. And the community can hold them accountable. And we also believe that investors themselves will hold these funds accountable to certain outcomes around social and environmental outcomes.
Okay. Can you be specific? Let's pick a city, or how do you see this really playing out? Because at a time when we have so many budget cuts, the government seems to be walking away and saying, you know what? We've got Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff. We've got Mark Zuckerberg, a very wealthy CEO of Facebook. Let's let them fund our hospitals and our communities. And we don't have to do that. And a lot of people have a problem with this because, you know, who's accountable at the end of the day? So can you explain how this is actually going to play out on the ground?
So I do think that local municipalities will also have an important role here to set local regulations and local policies that will help direct and drive capital in ways that the people who live and work in these communities currently can also benefit. You know, this is a federal tax benefit. It's a subsidy, and we believe strongly that it should have public benefit for people who are living in these communities. So a very specific example would be that often when there's private investment in a low-income community, if that community is contiguous to a higher-income community, then gentrification can take place. And there are tools and policies that can enable current residents to hold on to their homes and not be displaced in the face of new investment capital coming into these areas. Ways to do that could include a tax abatement for current residents at the time, starting at the time that investments are made into the communities, so that they can hold on to their homes, be able to avoid high rising tax rates or property tax rates, and participate in the accumulation of wealth in that community through the homes that they own. So that would be a specific example of a policy that a locality could implement to help offset some of the challenges that come with gentrification.
How else do you think gentrification can be avoided under this program?
So I think one of the ways you could think about development is having developers contribute to community services and projects that directly benefit the community as part of a zoning process that says, in order for you to build in this zone, you also have to be willing to contribute a certain amount to local community services. That's an example where community engagement and community pressure, whether it comes from social media or direct advocacy and lobbying, could make a difference. But I also believe that there are investors who are motivated not purely by financial return, but also are looking to have a positive impact in communities. And there is this whole class of investors known as impact investors that do set impact objectives for the investing that they make in any community. And I think it will be particularly important with opportunity zones for these type of objectives about, as outlined in the principles, about environmentally sound activities, types of businesses that benefit the community and don't harm them. For example, prohibitions against payday lending. So I think there are ways that investors themselves can self-regulate and police in ways that will have a direct benefit for the community.
Lisa Hall is senior fellow at Georgetown University's Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation. She has written about these opportunity zones and how they work. Rachel Riley is director of impact investing at Enterprise Community Partners, a community development and affordable housing organization. And today, this is something maybe you did not hear about, but this provision was buried in the Republican tax cut bill to, quote, help distressed Americans. And the law creates opportunity zones. They're designed to encourage investors to spend money in low-income and underserved neighborhoods, and in return, these investors will get a capital gains tax cut. More than 3 million Californians live in areas that could be designated as opportunity zones. So what are your thoughts about this? Are you familiar with this? If you live in a place that is called an opportunity zone, or if you live in a place where there were tax cuts given to investors to invest in your neighborhood, what was the outcome? Did the community have a seat at the table? How were these investors held accountable? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And coming up in about 20 minutes, we will mark the 15-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Speaking of money, we will talk about the trillions of dollars that have been spent on wars since 2001. Rachel, how do you address that question about who has a seat at the table and how can we ensure that community members will be able to really talk about what they need?
Yeah, we've been, Enterprise's role in the past couple months really has been taking the stance of pushing out information, educating both advocates and our partners working on the ground in communities throughout the nation. Especially in California, we have a really significant presence in the Bay Area and San Francisco, but as well as throughout the entire state, to talk with them about what Opportunity Zones program is, what it will do and what it won't do, what type of capital will be made available through opportunity funds. And both the challenges and associated potential negative threats, as Lisa mentioned, associated with that capital. And so I think what's going to be really important, the next steps following Opportunity Zone designations, will be how localities, how mayors and states really start creating this ecosystem and framework that helps to drive this capital in a way that meets the needs of communities and is aligned with local priorities and incents the types of social outcomes that we really need to be seeing in communities, so ensures that this displacement doesn't happen for residents and small businesses. We know after doing modeling that opportunity fund equity could be really advantageous in solving this gap that we're seeing in providing workforce housing. So housing that notoriously has been very difficult to fund because it hasn't been subsidized through the low-income housing tax credit program, but still serves a very important range of workers, especially in high-cost cities, that aren't necessarily eligible to live in homes that are subsidized through the housing credit program. And so we think that it can solve and help meet that equity gap need there. And really the intent of the legislation was to understand that there are these really great real estate deals and small businesses that are creditworthy throughout the nation, but maybe the private markets haven't been clued into these investment opportunities, or maybe there's a perceived risk around them because of where they're located. But through this tax incentive, now investors will be connected, and there will be some of this friction in the market that will be reduced because of this new special vehicle, special investment vehicle called an opportunity fund, that will help better facilitate the connectivity between investors and these investment opportunities in distressed communities.
But again,
to your point, it will be very important for localities to engage the community in that process of understanding what that ecosystem for policies and programs to move that capital in a responsible way will look like.
Just briefly, we've got about a minute before we go to break. If you live in a place that is designated an opportunity zone, you can assume that investors are looking at your neighborhood and deciding where they want to invest. How can you get information on that to find out what is actually happening before the decisions are made?
So I live 20 feet away from a potential opportunity zone. And the only way that I was able to find that out was because I live in Washington, D.C., so Washington, D.C. made that an open process. For many residents throughout the nation, that is not available to them because only about 30 states in the District of Columbia have made this publicly available knowledge. So there are a number of residents who have not yet had the opportunity to understand how states are moving forward.
Hmm. Lisa, why is that? Do you know?
Well, I think that the statute was designed to empower local government, and every government has made a choice about how they want to approach this process. I think, to Rachel's point, that where we are going to see a lot of influence is with the creation of opportunity funds and the actual vehicles that investors will use to invest in communities. And one thing I would recommend is that people reach out to their local community development financial institution. These types of institutions already work very closely with private investors, and you can go to the United States Treasury website to find a list of certified community development financial institutions. I think that is a great first point of contact for folks who are interested in understanding how investors will come into these markets.
Today, we are talking about a provision that was buried in the Republican tax cut bill to, quote, help distressed Americans. The law creates opportunity zones. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Facebook data has been used in elections before, but never like this. Cambridge Analytica consulted for the Trump campaign. Lawmakers in the U.S. and the U.K. want to know how Cambridge grabbed more than 50 million Facebook profiles, monitoring and manipulating millions of voters before the election. Is Facebook still a force for good? Next time on 1A.
1.5 hour from now, 11 o'clock this morning, right after your call for 1A. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on your call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to yourcall@klw.org. You may go to our website, which is yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. She runs a wellness clinic for children in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood. She really gets to the root of the problem rather than just prescribing drugs to children. She's out with a new book called The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. That is tomorrow. Later on this show, in about 10 minutes, we will mark the 15-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq by talking about the trillions of dollars that have been spent on the wars, and we'll talk about who's actually tracking that. Today, we are talking about a provision that was buried in the Republican tax cut bill. It creates so-called opportunity zones. They're designed to encourage investment in low-income and underserved neighborhoods. In return, investors will get a capital gains tax cut. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about how this works, if something like this has happened in your neighborhood, we'd love to hear from you. If you study this kind of thing and you'd like to talk about the outcomes, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by Lisa Hall, impact investor, senior fellow at Georgetown University's Beck Center for Social Impact. Rachel Riley is director of impact investing at Enterprise Community Partners, a community development and affordable housing organization. Can you talk about how these decisions will be made at a time when you've got a very bustling Bay Area, but a lot of inequality? I mean, we have massive wealth and a massive inequality. What would make someone invest in a place that has a lot of things going on, a big return, for example, versus investing in Stockton? What would you say, Lisa? Are you familiar with Stockton?
Yes.
Okay.
I am. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of reasons to invest in underserved communities. And because they have been traditionally underserved and have not had access to capital, there are a lot of very innovative businesses that, if given the chance to scale, would actually generate very solid returns. I think often these communities are ignored because the assumption is that there aren't people that are industrious and innovative and creative because they're low income. But actually, both in the U.S. and abroad, it's been proven that when people are given the resources and the access to capital, they actually make a lot out of it. And they can have very thriving businesses serving their communities in ways that only they know how to serve them because they've been based there. So I think that there is tremendous opportunity not only for people to do good by investing in these communities, but also to earn money.
What would you add, Rachel?
Yeah, I think what's going to be critical to this program is ensuring that, like any good tax policy, it is incenting activity that wouldn't otherwise occur. So one of the ways that I think California especially has a real opportunity to drive the capital into activities that it wants to incent or wants to see happen is through its state treatment of capital gains. And so one of the other things that has been noted as a potential downfall of the opportunity zones tax benefit is the lack of reporting associated with it. And so an idea that's been floated is whether or not the state of California could do some sort of specialized treatment or preferential treatment on how it, at the state level, capital gains is treated and then attach some sort of disclosure requirement to it so that investors in, say, if the state of California has prioritized investments into disadvantaged small businesses or affordable homes, that opportunity funds that are investing into those activities could potentially also get additional incentives on the state level treatment of their capital gains. But then we would also have an understanding through those disclosure requirements that are attached to that incentive at the state level of how opportunity funds are investing.
Let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I may have missed something at the beginning, but I'm a little bit suspicious of this program, and I wondered if you could tell me who were the prime movers behind it, who's likely to invest, what types of people are likely to invest in these zones, what kind of profits they will make from it. It seems like it's something that just kind of slipped in, and maybe, you know, whether Mark Zuckerberg is going to be the main investor, and I just wonder if you can satisfy my suspicions.
Well, thank you. The New York Times had a piece on this, and according to this piece, we briefly talked about this earlier, the zones were included in the tax law by Senator Tim Scott, a South Carolina Republican, and he was a co-sponsor of a previous iteration of a bill, and that included Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, House lawmakers from both parties. According to this piece, a tech mogul, Sean Parker of Napster and Facebook, enlisted Senator Tim Scott and others to sponsor the legislation. Lisa, you weren't here for that part of the show. What else can you tell us about where this comes from?
So I think you gave a great history of the legislative background of this new tax benefit. I think also Economic Innovation Group was very involved in lobbying and advocating for it, and they have a lot of information on their website about the history. But your listener is asking a lot of good questions about who's going to invest in this. Mm-hmm. And there are this category of investors called impact investors who are actually looking for financial returns, but they also are interested in their investments generating some type of social or environmental benefit. And I think opportunities funds will be of great interest to impact investors who will be setting impact objectives for their investments and not purely looking for an economic return. And, you know, they are motivated by, for many reasons. Sometimes they're motivated to build goodwill in a community because they have other business or services that they are offering. Sometimes they're motivated to make these types of investments because they've created a lot of wealth and feel an obligation to share that wealth with others. And so there are lots of different motivations for people wanting to be impact investors. But the thing that sets them apart from traditional investors is an intentionality about generating some type of social or environmental benefit, as well as a commitment to actually measure that benefit over time. And I think you're very likely to see impact investors attracted to these funds as a way to make money, but also to do good in communities that have been underserved over time.
Do you think that a large majority of these investors will come from the tech industry?
So there will also be investors, some perhaps from the tech industry, who are not impact investors but are looking solely for returns. And I think that's why it's very important for communities and advocates and community development practitioners to be vocal about the types of things that matter for good place-based community investment. And it's why we created the 10 principles that speak to types of activities, types of monitoring and tracking of these investments over time. It's a proposed set of guiding principles for governors as they think about how they're designating zones. But we also hope to move those principles towards a guiding set of principles for investors as they think about making investments in opportunity zones.
And final questions. How can people keep track of this and make sure that the community has a seat at the table as we are nearing the end of the decision-making process? Lisa?
So I would again say reach out to your community development financial institutions and others in your community that are already actively working with investors. There's a program called the New Markets Tax Credit that has been in existence for over a decade, actually I think 2 decades now, where investors have already developed projects in some of these communities that will end up being designated as opportunity zones. And you can look them up by looking at the New Markets Tax Credit Coalition. You can look them up by looking at Opportunity Finance Network, which is the trade group of community development financial institutions. And I would say also reach out to the local offices of networks like Enterprise Community Partners or LIS, the Local Initiative Support Corporation. There are many practitioners in the field of community development that are paying very close attention to the opportunity zones and looking to engage communities and work with foundations and philanthropists and local policy makers and government officials to make sure that this new benefit really does benefit the people who currently live and work in opportunity zones.
Lisa Hall is a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Beck Center for Social Impact. Rachel Riley is director of impact investing at Enterprise Community Partners, a community development and affordable housing organization. Lisa and Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you can find more information about these so-called opportunity zones at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we will mark the 15-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq by talking about the cost of wars. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.